Well, I should, for purposes of the tape, should say that it's August 24th, 1990, and this is Geneva Kiebler-Wiskeman, and I'm sitting here with Phyllis Fitzpatrick, Mrs. Doyle Fitzpatrick. We're at Paradise Bay on Beaver Island. And what a beautiful spot, Phyllis, to look out and see the lighthouse right out here. Now, you've been on the island 14 years.
This August, actually.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
And you and Doyle both were long-term employees of General Motors Oldsmobile.
Right. He was 32 years and I was 28, actually. Mm. Although I had some interrupted service. You know, I left at one time and then came back, but it dated back to, you know, 28 years. It would have been more, but when you break your service, then it... They start you back, so... He went there during the war, actually, because he had run a business on his own, actually, of artwork and doing freelance type of artwork, and then went to Oldsmobile.
And you did stenographic work for us?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
At the time you went to work, probably there weren't very many opportunities for different kinds of jobs that we have to, compared to what we have today.
No, there were, you know, it was typing and filing, and I actually went there during the war too, and worked in engineering, and there were three girls that were out there in this huge area, this huge big room where all the engineers were, the draftsmen, working the drafting boards, but we were out there in the middle, kind of, and we were surrounded by files, huge files that went from the floor way up, where they filed all these blueprints and the parts of the cannons and the shells and all these things that we were working on. And then we would also collate them, you know, and put them together, and they were distributed different places. And then all these copies that we had to keep were filed. And it was very routine and kind of boring job, but it had to be done. Sometimes we'd have these little milk stools, like, that we'd sit way down on the floor for those things and to get to the low drawers, and then we had to have a high stool to get up to the kind of the top ones, you know. But the only real part about it that made it all worthwhile was that we were out there among all these fellows, and they kept it very entertaining. You know, they picked on us a lot and teased us and came over and talked, and this was allowed, you know. It was all very well, kind of like family, and we enjoyed that, and so that kept all the boredom away. And then I especially enjoyed it because if some of the secretaries would go on vacation, why then they'd have me come over and work for them, because I could type and I do dictation, so I got to have a little experience that way. So I eventually, you know, got a stenographic job because of it, but I had worked at the Weather Bureau before that, and I was so tickled to get an Oldsmobile. It was so much, you know, I liked it so much better that I was willing to do a very mediocre job because I figured that sometime there'd be a better chance.
You worked at the Weather Bureau?
Mm-hmm, East Lansing.
That must have been an interesting job.
It was, kind of, but I had a very difficult boss. And I was a state employee, actually. I was a secretary. The other people in the office were federal. He was federal government. And there was a fellow and I think two girls. They were all federal and I was state because I was the secretary. That was a funny setup. Excuse me, but it was kind of interesting, you know, different things, but not really, I didn't have too much to do with that. The interesting part was, you know, where they
got them information in, you know, about the weather and the things they typed up and sent out. But the interesting part was, like, you get a lot of phone calls from people asking the weather and asking different questions, and that was interesting. And I, you know, if I didn't know, I could ask one of them. So that part was fun. And I didn't have too much to do with it, but I learned some things, you know, just by being around the rest of them and the equipment and all. But you, were you a native of Lansing?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes, I was a native of Lansing. Went to school there,
mm-hmm.
Eastern High School, and I went to Washington State for about 2.5 years. Then you went to work,
mm-hmm.
And that's where you met Doyle?
I met Doyle Dosenville, yes. I worked, before the Weather Bureau, I worked at Auto Owners Insurance. And I had been going to business school, just taking special courses in typing and dictation, I mean, business English and things like that. And during that time, I was there for maybe 3 or 4 months, and finally decided I better just get a job. And so somebody told me that auto owners would have certain days a week that they interviewed girls for jobs. And so I went down there, and there were about 25 girls waiting to be interviewed. And I was the last one. I sat there all afternoon. Oh, I was, you know, very nervous, and the longer you sat there, the more nervous you got, and everybody go in and come back out, and you wondered, you know, I wonder if they got the job. But they interviewed all of us, you know, they didn't just say, well, make up their mind, say, well, she's hired, and you, the rest of you don't need to wait. So I was the last one. And so this gentleman was Jim Otto, who did the interviewing. And so he said to me, you know, if you don't hear from me within a couple of days, you call me. He said, you call me. So I think it was like on a Friday when I was there. And so then the next morning, being Saturday, he called me and he said, if you want a job, you will have a job, you know. So when can you come in? And can you come, you know, like on Monday? And I said I could. And so that was a very interesting experience. And I learned, started out like in underwriting, learning where you figure the policies. And I went through a whole bit there before I got a secretarial job there. Mm-hmm.
It was a nice company to work for. It was, you know, that's where I really got my first chance. They were willing to give inexperienced people, you know, training and give them a chance to work.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that was very hard, you know, even way back years ago, that you couldn't necessarily just walk out and get a job if you had never worked before. And you know, how could you have experience if nobody ever gave you a chance? That's the bad part.
You still hear the same stories.
Sure.
You know, how do you
get experience if you won't
somebody? Somebody has to be a mentor.
That's right. And they were noted for that. Yeah, that was. And then from the billing, or the figuring, that part of it, then I worked in the part where they had the billing, all the machines where they type the policies up. And it was a special machine that you use like a typewriter, but how they were threaded on this long kind of roller thing, and how they fed on this and then cut off, but we couldn't make any mistakes, and that was pretty tough. And they saved all these, you know, all of them that you made a mistake on and had to destroy or put to one side, you had to put in one place like a wastebasket, and they checked those all over every night to see how many you had, and if you had too many, they really told you about it because that was costly, you know, paper and all the waste. And the woman in charge of it was a woman, and she was really tough. She really was, and she
there were a lot of girls in there. It's a great big area where we worked, and she had to be that way because she wouldn't let you talk to anybody unless you asked her if you could, you know, if you want to talk to the girl in front of you about something. You had to ask her if you could speak to her, and she'd usually say yes, you know.
Well, if you visited, you would make mistakes.
Sure. And, you know, if she had all these people and all these machines running, all the noise and people talking and everything, too, why, she had to be that way. But they all thought she was really a
driving money.
She knew her business, so she stuck to it. But she was all right if you, you know, played fair with her. You asked permission if you didn't talk to him unless it was important, so. And then I remember this girl that sat back of me, and she had fingernails that were way out. I swear they were an inch long, and she would be typing on this machine. And how she could, I just couldn't believe it, that she could do that and type on those nails. How she could do it with, and, you know, and be accurate, not make mistakes. But just typing with those long, long claws, actually. But she did. And this was before auto owners had their building and were all together, and they had, you know, offices in three or four different places all over Lansing, and that made it
and they built
an operation.
After the war, they came together in a building there on Townsend Street. They bought where the Patton Yard House was.
Yes.
And tore that down.
Yeah. Had a nice office building.
Then eventually they outgrew that and moved out.
Right.
To the suburban area.
Yes.
Familiar pattern of development. You've been up when Doyle retired. Did you retire together?
No,
or?
He retired about a year and a half before I did, and I was able to retire that soon because they had it was actually a similar situation during an oil crisis in the 70s, and they were then, you know, trying to cut headcount back, and so they were offering special retirements for people who were 55 and over, and I was 55, so I was able to go on a very special deal, and I was glad because he'd been retired about a year or a little more, so it worked out really nicely.
I know that after his book was finished, I think some of his energies began to be devoted to this house, the creation. Did he design the house?
No. We found that a friend of ours showed us this. It was a house of the week that was in the State Journal. On Sunday, they would have a house, house plans, and tell about it. And we'd already found one that we liked. It was like a double A-frame, like where it was, you know, kind of one angle, one way, and one facing another. It was a good plan, but then a friend of ours had cut this out because he had known that we were interested in the ground and in this property. And he said, I found this, and I think it might be something you could use. And we liked it better because it seemed to fit the lot better. It had to be one that was narrow on one end and then ran the long way of the property, because there was a lot next door available, but the woman wouldn't sell it. We didn't acquire that until after we had built the house. Otherwise, we could have moved it over more, you know, more in the center, but she wouldn't sell it at the time. So we sent for the plans through the State Journal and got the blueprints and everything. And we had quite a time to find anybody that would build it. You know, that was one thing. We had given the plans to a local builder, and there weren't very many on the island at the time. Just this one probably had the bulk of the building. And he had the plans for almost a year and never would give us a quote or a price or any information. And I guess he just really was afraid to tackle it, but he didn't want to say so. And finally, one time when we came up here, Bill just went over to his house and just said, "I want the plans back." So then we tried to figure out how we could get it built.
Many of the things you have in the house came from the Ariel's residence.
Yes.
That went down for to make way for 496.
Right.
Some of the beveled glass doors and mm-hmm.
the windows.
The decorative art glass windows.
Leaded glass windows, yes, and then the bedroom windows, all three were in the ballroom, matching the ballroom. And
This medallion that you have implanted into the stone fireplace, mm-hmm. Can you tell us a story about that?
That was from Oldsmobile and up over the company car garage that was attached to the administration building. And when they raised the building, all of those just came down. And when they were doing this, Doyle went out there and talked to the men who were working on it and said, you know, would it be possible to get a couple of those and explained how he wanted to use them. And they said, well, we aren't going to go to any big effort to save them, but if we just happen to get one that comes out all right and doesn't break, why, fine, you absolutely can purchase that, but we're not going to, you know, just sit here and take pains that it doesn't break or break up when it falls. So, but we're able to get two, so it worked out very well. One outside in the chimney and the one in here.
One on the outside, it looks like a phoenix.
A phoenix, it is. Mm-hmm. These were beautiful all along the, you know, the edge of the garage.
Very distinctive decorations.
You didn't think too much about it when you went by there every day and looked at them, but then after it got moved and put in, you know, where it stood out, just one, you think about it, everybody always notices that. And we thought the bird looked like a robin, and that was the state bird, and so we thought, well, that'd be pretty to have that one, so we're glad that was one of them that they saved, and also the phoenix was very mm-hmm. special.
Yes, there's two birds supporting the flower.
Mm-hmm. And Doyle always said that was an eagle, but it really wasn't. It was outside, it was a phoenix. And the man who did the stonework was, you know, interested in it, and he was very willing to put it in. Because we weren't here when he did most of it, just told him, sketched it out and how he wanted it to go. First we planned to put both of them inside, and then we decided, no, it wasn't, you know, it was too much, it just needed one, so one inside and one out worked out very well.
This is just the right size from where you have
yes,
here.
Yes, it is.
Right side as you face the fireplace.
Because the other one was a little larger, and so the outside fireplace or chimney is massive, so it fit in there very well.
Do you have other things that came from the old residence that I'm not looking at?
Let's see, I'm trying to think. Of course, those doors were in the ballroom too, that French door there and the one that goes downstairs. I think that's about all I can remember.
Oh, and the chandelier. Well, that's an outstanding feature of this cathedral ceiling.
Yeah, the chandelier was in the Greek Orthodox Church in Lansing that was very close to Oldsmobile, and they tore that down to build a new church. And the chandelier had been given to the church by Angel Pergoris, who was, I think had owned a restaurant at one time in Lansing, and had gone over to Greece and had seen this and decided to give it to the church. And at one time it was not electrified, it was just, you know, candles.
Mm-hmm.
But he shipped it back or to Lansing for the church, but somehow or other it got lost and it wound up in some South American country, and they finally traced it back and did get it back to Lansing. But Father Poulos, who was a pastor at the time, you know, wanted a really good home for the chandelier because he felt so badly they couldn't use it in the new church because that was going to be a modern structure and this wasn't going to fit in. So he had several offers, I guess, for it, but when he found out what we were going to do with it, then he was very, very interested, and so he said, oh, that's yours, you can just count on that, you can have it, you can plan on it, because he said, I know it'll be in a good place, and that's where I want it.
Well, we're sitting here at midday, and it catches even the light, even though it's an overcast day here on Beaver Island. Tonight, I'm going to walk down by the shore and look back.
Oh, that's a sight. That's a sight to behold.
It must be like a lighthouse.
Yeah, yes. And sometimes in the evening, if you know, we would turn it on just so people coming in the harbor on boats or something could see it. And it is a sight to see when you look down from the beach up back up and see it, because you don't expect to see that, for one thing. And this structure is only half of it. The full chandelier, that's 19 arms, and there are 19 more that we didn't put up because it would be so massive.
What?
And then there were, it was solid with crystal. We purposely wanted the skeleton to show through, you know, so it wouldn't look so ornate. Because he told me what he wanted to do and put that in this house, I said that would look terrible. It's too ornate and too big, and it won't fit in there at all. But he was right. He said we won't put it all up, and that's half of it.
Did you save the other part?
Yes, uh-huh. It didn't have another center part. You'd only be enough for another chandelier if you could get the center, the ball in the center, you know, glass
spindle,
and all that part.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a lot of crystal still that we didn't use.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know where you would ever get the other part. I've often thought I should contact somebody, you know, and see if there'd be a need for it, because somebody might have some other parts that would all fit
in.
It's
a gorgeous piece, and it's now just the right size for this.
Yes. It really is.
You have no idea how old the piece really is, do you?
I'm not really sure. I don't know if he has it written down. I don't recall coming across that anywhere, but he might have written down about it, because he did document some of those things. But we had quite a job getting it down. Excuse me. At that time, they were just doing Oldsmobile's new office building, and the man was in charge of a lot of the interior work was from Detroit, and he told Doyle that, he said, that chandelier is a real bargain. He said, you should be sure that you do get it, and he said, I'll help you so you can get it down, because it was up real high in the church, well, just about as high as it's hanging there. And so he built a scaffolding, and we went down on a Saturday and got it up there and took it down. And then there was a man who worked around the church and did odd jobs for them, who took the whole center part down, the chain and all the main part of it. We took all the crystal off and put it in boxes and labeled it. And on the outside, he drew a picture of each piece, you know, that was in the box, so we knew where they were. And we had, I think, 7 boxes all together when it was all apart.
It's an outstanding piece.
Yes.
Now, I know from being in Dr. Joyce Thomas's office a few weeks ago, Phyllis, that you donated some materials there to the Lansing Room of the Public Library.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Can you tell us for the record how that happened?
Well, it happened because I was disposing of some of his books, and through a mutual friend, I was in contact with Shirley Slyker of Lansing, who's a book dealer, and she came up here to visit her friend, who was on Beaver Island also, and looked at the books, and then we talked about some of the things that were historical about Lansing, about the Oles family, about Oldsmobile. And she mentioned that the Lansing Library would be very happy to have things like that, because there were many places that they also worked with the Oles Museum, and they kind of interchanged materials and things, and if they couldn't use some things, they would probably contact them to see if they could be used elsewhere. So that's how it came about. We found quite a few things that did pertain to Oldsmobile and pictures, and a lot of pictures that were taken during the war of the assembly line and the workers and different parts that they were featuring, you know, different new parts at Oldsmobile, and hydromatic drive and many different things that they were advertising. And then there were some executive pictures also. And just general information, some pictures of Lansing that were old Lansing that were from Ford Caesar's collection, actually, that Doyle had duplicated. So they had quite a variety, you know.
Ford had accumulated things that you find in the library and in the state archives that were from the old Edmunds Bowie collections. And they may have been, and then Ford took a lot of photographs through the years of it with his own camera.
Yeah, I'm not sure which they were. I think that most of these, I think, might have been duplicates from the
older era.
Right. They were very interesting pictures, but I thought that would be a better place for them than for me just to have them here, you know, to look at once in a while. But there was one time at the press club that Ford and Doyle and Roger Tobias put on an evening's program of old Lansing, and they had these pictures.
Oh, yes. And Roger was a good friend of Doyle. He loved Doyle.
Yes, he did.
And Roger was such an interesting man. I knew him, too.
Yes, I always missed him. He used to come over.
I still miss him.
And spend an evening, you know, and they'd get to talking about history and different things, and then he was very knowledgeable too because of his work at Michigan State Library.
Mm-hmm.
And it was always interesting to hear them. And he used to come over a lot and visit and call up, and they'd talk on the phone. And every Christmas he'd come over and bring some of their goodies, you know, that
the Lebanese
foods. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, Raji had gone to the American School. And because his father worked for Oldsmobile, he was part of that community of Lebanese people that were brought over by Ari Oles to work in the factory.
That's interesting. And I had forgotten about that, but I do remember you mentioning that too.
And he, of course, was not really trained for the world that he found he had to work in. I believe he ran a newspaper in Detroit in the Lebanese community for a while.
I believe that's right.
And he came to Lansing and had a restaurant opposite Umberland in there, opposite the factory.
That's right, yes, he did. He told us about that and the problems that he had. Yes, he was a very interesting man, very nice man.
When you say Doyle's books, did you have a remainder stock on his book on King Strang?
Yes, I still have it. There are about 3 boxes left, and about 24 in the box. And I get orders every now and then for, you know, like Fair State University and different bookstores, and not a lot, but occasionally. And they sell some on the island yet at the museum. And one store had a whole box this year and sold them all. So there's still orders coming in for them.
Mm-hmm.
But the supply is dwindling down. He had 5,000 printed, which was a lot for that type of a book. So
I believe he told me that at the time it was computer-generated text, and it was innovative at the time.
Yes, that's right.
It was very innovative at the time.
Right. Absolutely.
I don't know how long you worked on that.
On the book, mm-hmm. about 7 years before it was final.
Mm-hmm. How did he become interested in Beaver Island?
Well, actually, just mostly through George Egbert, who had had a place there for a long time and worked at Olsonville with him, and he used to talk to him about, to Doyle about the history of the island being very unique.
So George Egbert talked about the island, and George already had a cottage
here. He already had a cottage here, and he had come here for quite a few years, and he talked about there were many Mormon buildings down the island, and Doyle got very interested in that, but of course we found out that wasn't true. They really weren't, you know, there might have been some lumber that they had used from some Mormon buildings, but there weren't any Mormon buildings actually except a print shop, which is the museum. But he got very interested in the history because it was very unique about a Mormon era on Beaver Island, and then them being driven off the way they were, and then the Irish, you know, taking over. So he got quite absorbed in it, and sort of wrote things down, and always said he didn't realize he was writing a book. He just was kind of writing things down just to have a record of him. But first thing he knew, he was decided, well, King String wasn't really as bad as he was painted, and he wanted to prove it. You know, this was a big thing. But people up here would never agree with that, because they still, a lot of that has been dispelled. I think the book did a lot to correct that, but they still have their feelings about it. That was pretty bad, but people who come over here and visit and come to the museum, that is the main thing they want to know about, is King String and the Mormon era on Beaver Island, which is very unusual. And we've met many descendants, you know, from all the different wives, and very, very interesting people who've come, who've looked us up and have wanted to know how they fit into the whole picture. And usually was able to help them and to find us and trace it back. I have a lot of knowledge because of having typed the book so many times, but I don't have the ability to check this out and help them like he did and to trace it back. And if they could tell him, you know, who their grandfather was, or give him some names, he could find it. Usually I'll always find it for them.
Well, he used primary resources and used good research techniques.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been a very, very interesting experience. And this one fellow who came last summer, Jim Strang, who was the great-great-grandson of the king, lives in New Mexico, and he has traced the family from, he was from Sarah, the fourth polygamous wife, and he has really researched that and traced that and knows the history very thoroughly and is fascinated by it and follows it up, and his two sons also do. But he's not interested in the other branches of the family from the other wives, or in following that, or piecing it all together, or getting all of it, you know, fit into the whole, just of the one particular one. And most all of them are like that. They want to know about their one particular
line,
yes. And they're all very interesting. So when you sit back and see them all together, you know, and all the different ones and meet them, it's really wonderful. You know, I have that advantage that they don't have, really, because you get to see the whole
picture. They have
picture.
A common gene background, mm-hmm. and a common ancestry to a degree.
Right.
And yet they isolate themselves from part of it.
Yes, that's true, that's true. And they don't seem that interested in the other, you know. And all of them have been remarkable. It seems like they're very talented, are special, do have, the genes seem to carry through. This one who visited us was a very talented person. He was a flyer and flew for Great Lakes Steel and several companies, and he had his own air transport service and charter service, and does now repair work on instruments, aviation instruments, and still flies and still very good pilot, and is a very fascinating person. All of them seem to have a lot of charisma.
Is this man you've been describing, Jim?
Jim, yes, he was here last summer. He visited us in Lansing 19 years ago and came to the house and spent an evening with us, and at that time wasn't that interested in the family, but got interested over a period of time, and then later on just studied it a lot more. But the connection was that Hazel Strain McArdle was his great-great aunt, and she was the lady that helped Doyle so much with the book and told him a lot of things, a lot of history, and gave him different things to use in his book. And she was one of the few that was not ashamed of the fact that she was a Strain, and most of the families at one time or another were kind of hid with it from the rest of their children and other generations of who they really were. But she had always been very open about it and was very proud of the fact of who she was, and she helped Doyle a lot with the book. Mm-hmm. So that was why we had a close tie-in with her, and a lot of correspondence that they did. And I gave all of this correspondence to him to sort over and to keep, and to keep what he wanted and what he didn't want to, you know, just to destroy. But it told, she had a journal of when she was a child and how they journeyed from Oklahoma way up into Canada where they had this farm, and they still have this farm today. It's in his family, and he, all the children own a portion of it. So they keep the, you know, they kept this intact over all the years, so it's interesting.
Was Hazel in this area? Do you know how Doyle got in touch with her?
I don't know how he heard about her somehow or other and started writing to her, and they had a very, over a long period of years, a very lucrative correspondence, and all these letters that were several file folders, and told a lot about, you know, her, about the family, and about things she remembered, and it helped him a lot, you know, in getting the book organized and different things that she knew that she remembered and that she was proud of knowing and didn't try to keep it hidden, which was the case in many families, and they just didn't want to admit who they were, changed their name, and just never said they were, you know. But the book did a lot to do away with that kind of thing. Then they came forward, and we had heard from many of them all over the country, even those that are not directly related but go back to a common grandfather, you know, or someone way back.
If Jim has that correspondence, it might be available for microfilming, and adding to the material that you gave to the Lansing Public Library would be a collateral collection to support the book publication and continue to be used.
Yes, it could be. And then, of course, Doyle has a microfilm that he used from Yale University of the, you know, that he used to put into the book. And he didn't use everything, but you know, I still have that. So that's available, you know, if anybody ever wanted to research that more thoroughly. And then there was a young man here last summer also from Grand Rapids area whose name was Strain, and wanted to know how he fit into the family background and picture, and thought he was related to the king. But when Doyle checked it out, he was not, except way back through a common a relative. But we did find out that he was related to one of them who was a murderer, and way back in the East, and had been hanged for murder. And he thought that was about as notorious as though he'd been related to the king. So he came back up the summer. I saw him in the library, and he was mentioning it again, you know, that how he was able to find this out.
Mm-hmm.
And hadn't known, you know, how he fit in before.
Was this a Michigan-oriented story? Was this a murder in Michigan?
Or no, it was back in the East.
Back in the East.
Yes. Mm-hmm. He didn't really know, and all of a sudden then he mentioned some names, you know, that he was familiar with. And so I was able to, through this one work that Charles Strange did, who was related also, but back through a common ancestor who did a lot of genealogy on the family. They had put out this publication, Strains of Westchester, and Doyle had this all together in a book, a real thick book, and so he was able to trace that back, and that's how he found how the young man tied in, and that it was this person was an actual convicted murderer.
How did the young man react to that?
He thought it was very interesting, and he, you know, his wife thought it was kind of terrible, but he thought it was pretty neat, really. Almost as though, you know, as good as being the king, related to the king.
Are there any descendants living on the island today?
No, no Mormons. There are a few Strangites still in existence who practice the religion, and there, you know, a lot of them are in New Mexico area, some up in Burlington, Wisconsin, some out west a little further, California, Colorado, but not very many that practice it, but there's still a few. There was one in Lansing, Stanley Johnson, I don't know if you remember him, but he was a very devout follower. He had a lot of material on string. And I think that his material went to the Clark Library in Mount Pleasant. I think that's what his wife said, that she had disposed of it.
Is he still alive?
No. Stanley died a few years ago.
I remember seeing him one time at the archives when Dr. Mason was there.
Yes. Mm-hmm. He had a lot of information. Quite a collection, too, of different pamphlets and things, and was quite helpful, you know, about sharing information.
I know it's not easy to decide what to send where, and Doyle was a real saver of materials.
Yes, definitely. And one thing that I'm puzzled about what I should do with is this diary. Edward Chidester, who was the postmaster and a very loyal follower, String wrote this little diary that Doyle acquired a few years ago, and it tells of the actual shooting and taking String from the island back to Burlington, and of his actual death. And all that is very, very, you know, valuable information.
Do you have that now?
Yes, I do.
And you're trying to determine the best place
yes,
for it to be.
That's right.
Is this something you want to sell on the market, Phyllis, or are you able to financially to donate it?
I hate to think of anything as important in history as that being sold for a price, but I don't know either the best place to donate it, you know, where it would be of the most value, and be, it's very delicate, couldn't be handled or actually looked at by people because of
delicacy of it and the fragile nature of it. It couldn't be reproduced because that would be, you know, too difficult. It's too...
You have to be transcribed very carefully.
Yes.
What, do you remember what the dates are approximately?
Let's see. I think... I'm not sure. It starts like in January and mentions a meeting that was being held, and then goes on up to the time when he was actually assassinated. And this the year that was 1856, I think, wasn't it? And goes on through. And then there were several other diaries, but they're not, they're just general and tell about life in general after that, maybe. Not really interesting. This one tells the whole actual shooting. And it's just unbelievable. It will tell this in maybe one sentence or one line. And just, you know, it just says so much in a few words.
This was, the diarist was the postmaster here on the island?
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Fortunate.
And the printer, also the printing office. He worked in the printing office too. You know, where they had the newspaper. Mm-hmm. Printed the, well, it was actually the only newspaper north of Grand Rapids for a long time. But a lady had this. There were this diary and two or three others that were together in an old shoebox, and she lived in East Tawas, and she had seen an article in Free Press that had been written up about Doyle. There were quite a few pieces done by reporters who came here and interviewed him and who did stories on the island, and it had been this one particular time in the Free Press and had quite an article about him and pictures and mentioned the book. And this lady had found in this shoebox out in her garage, an old, old garage that they were going to tear down because of wanting to sell the property and not wanting the building on it. And somehow she saw this old box in there, and she looked in it to see what was in the box. And she found these diaries, and she wouldn't have thought much about it except she had seen the article in the paper. And so after she put two and two together, she realized that she had something important. She called him on the phone and asked Doyle if he would be interested in buying it. And he said yes, he would, you know, and so then they kind of tried to figure out a price, you know, of what it would be worth. And she said, well, I don't know. And he said, would $50 be okay? And she said, oh yes, that'd be fine. And so he said, well, I don't really know unless I look at it. But he said to her to mail it, registered mail or certified mail. And she said, no, she said, I'm going to bring it up there in person. I'm going to bring it. I'll bring it right up to you. She said, I wanted to see be round, and now I really am interested. And I said, I'm going to bring it. So she did.
Mm-hmm.
And when he looked at it, then he knew it was very important. But she does not know how it came to be in this building, how it got there, anything about, you know, getting it or how she happened to have it. It seems that some of the family of this man must have been around in that area somehow, but how it got in that old garage, nobody seems to know.
The provenance up to that point is very obscure.
Mm-hmm.
What a fascinating story.
I think after she had disposed of it, she sort of wished she hadn't in a way. I mean, after she sold it to him, because she wanted, always wanted parts of it. So we did photostat very carefully, you know, those main pages and send them to her. But she didn't know what to do with it either, but she, you know, got in a good place. But now I have the same problem of wondering what to do with it, because it is a very important document.
Let me think about that a while. Maybe I can make some suggestions.
Right. I really don't. I'm sure it would be valuable, you know, monetarily, but I hate to have a price put on something like that. It's
difficult to put a price on.
Yes, it is.
On a one-of-a-kind item of that nature.
That's right. It could
you know, could be worth a lot, but it's just the idea that it should be somewhere, you know, where it will be taken care of. I really should be up here, I think, but they don't have, you know, the museum here does not have anything to preserve, and it's already very delicate. Mm-hmm. It seems like it should, it's a definitely a Michigan item, but it truly is, it'd be Rhineland, but, you know, it would be very foolish to put it here under the conditions, because it's damp, they have no way to, you know, to keep the moisture out or mm-hmm. any way to protect it.
Yeah. It's never been exploited in any way.
No. A strange thing happened, though. There was, we received a letter from a gentleman in Independence, Missouri, who says he has the largest string collection of material of any place, and mentions 3,500 items or something like that that has to do with string material. And somehow or other, I don't know how, but he found out about it. He wrote us a letter, and it was after Doyle had become ill from one of the many strokes he had, and he couldn't answer him, but I did write to him and told him that he wanted to know if we had considered or would consider releasing this to him so he could reprint it and then publish it, you know, probably sell it.
Oh.
And I just wrote and told him that that was impossible to do because it was so delicate it couldn't be handled and it would just fall apart if anybody tried to duplicate it in any way. And told him that he was ill, you know, and that he couldn't answer, but that I was answering for him. And so then I did hear from, he wrote me a letter after Doyle died and said he was sorry to hear about it and wanted to know what I planned to do with any of his material. And he came to the island this summer and did come to see me. And he asked if he could see the diary and I showed it to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I would give you a couple hundred dollars for it. And I said, no way. So, but how he ever knew about it, I do not know. I should have asked him, but I didn't. He was a young man, too, very surprisingly so, about late 20s. But very, very interested in string and a string night, apparently.
And you have his address and know how to contact him.
Yes, I do. And he told me an interesting tale that Independence, where they do apparently have Latter-day Saints, a big headquarters, that they have string scepter. And I always felt that the crown and the scepter and the robe were theatrical sort of stage props, yes. And, you know, that this was just used in the ceremony here and it was just a symbolic thing of the coronation, which they call it. But he told me that they have the scepter, and it was made out of wood, and described it, and it was a burled type of wood, and some real old lady had had this in her possession for many years, and that they were able to acquire it. And, you know, I just couldn't help but think it was, you know, just couldn't be true.
Oh, you questioned the authority of that.
I did, yes. Mm-hmm. But he said he'd seen it. Well, when he told me they had the scepter, then I think I said to him, do you have the crown and the robe also? You know, because it, to me it was just a kind of, a prop, really. But whether this is true or not, I don't know. I don't recall ever seeing anywhere where it mentioned about what the scepter was made of or anything.
So, but he didn't have any of the other things that you mentioned?
No, he didn't know about that, no. So I don't understand that. I really can't quite believe it. But he did, definitely did.
And this is in a church-sponsored collection?
No, it's his own private collection. And he told me that he has this kind of like in his own home, kind of like a library-type thing. He has all these cases and places that he stores all his material. But this scepter was in the church collection, uh-huh, at the Latter-day Saints.
That's apparently what I thought I heard.
But he said he'd send me a catalog of all these items he has, but so far I don't have it. So I would be interested in, you know, seeing what our list was. And he knew of a lot of different things that Doyle had had. And a few years back, he sold a lot of Mormon things to a podiatrist out in California whom we had met, who was interested in strain. Being a true Mormon, this was a very unusual thing because most of them did not really acknowledge him as being, you know, really even existing. But he was very interested in him, and so Doyle sold him some books and things that were mostly Mormon, but there were a few other things too. And this gentleman who came this summer knew that he'd, now how he knew that, I don't know. He knew that Doyle had sold them to him, so it's strange.
But there probably was a network of the faithful and of the scholars that,
right,
where they shared information.
That's true. And then he did mention that Brigham Young University had quite a collection. So through all these different sources, they probably find this out somehow.
And then he came here and you verified it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, right.
That's fascinating.
Mm-hmm. He was very very pleasant young man. He and his wife came. They were very nice young couple, but I couldn't, you know, I really didn't get into it with him about why he was so interested. But I said, are you really a Strainite? Do you follow his teachings? And he said, yes, I do. He said, except, of course, the polygamy, you know. And I said, well, yes. But he, and the Strainites in Wisconsin follow his teachings, but they don't, aren't that interested in him as a person, but they follow the religious part of him. So it's strange. To me, you couldn't really be interested in one without the other. Well, it just goes on and on and on, and all the connections and all the people and all the interesting things that have come up because of that book. All the people even back that have come here that we, you know, wrote to. It seems like every little while, even today, there's somebody writing, asking how they fit in or wanting to buy the book to see if they tie in, you know, and mm-hmm. Or if it's not Strain directly, some of their family were families here on the island, you know, that were followers of his.
Mm-hmm.
So it just goes on.
That's the importance of that, keeping that correspondence file.
Mm-hmm, right.
Tangible evidence.
Yes. Yeah, it's very, very interesting. I got several real thick files and, you know, inquiries in general and then quite a few specific ones. So.
That's wonderful that you were involved with the book publication and Doyle's long interest so that you can
mm-hmm.
follow up on that.
Well, and the whole story itself of publishing it, founding his own publishing company and picking out the paper and picking out the bookbinder and establishing the company itself under the name and all because he couldn't get anybody to publish it and do it the way he wanted. Got quality paper and quality binding and everything, you know, special, and founding the company to do it purposely was fascinating to me.
He just went ahead and did it
mm-hmm.
to get the quality production,
right.
He did.
And set up this name, and it came up for renewal again this last year, which I renewed it again for a five-year term, but probably when the books are sold, then it won't be necessary to keep it, but still sell some. But it's a whole really interesting, it was a very interesting experience, the whole thing. And not easy either, but because, you know, at that time we risked quite a bit of money doing it all on our own, and he always said he never wanted to make money on it, just get the money back, which he did. And it still sells for the same price it started out for. And books are very expensive today, but still sells for the same price, $7.95 plus shipping. And paperbacks are more than that.
Oh, yes. That's more.
Yeah, it's very, very unusual.
Well, you've not only told the strange story and about primary resources, but you've told the story of a Michigan author who published his own. And that's the only book he ever published.
Yes, never had any interest. Everybody would say, when are you going to do another volume? When are you going to go on with that? When are you going to do this? And he's not interested. I just don't want to do anything. I just accomplished what I set out to do, and that's it. So he did have a collection from a man who was here on the island, who was a very interesting person in island history also, named Protar.
Oh, yes.
Fyodor Protar, and he did write down a lot of things about him, and had originally was going to publish a book about both of them, one part about Protar and one part about Strang, and then decided that that wasn't too good an idea, that each one deserved a special book, you know, and so if he had to choose, he decided Strang was the more interesting one. And there is a lady who comes to the island every year who's done much research on Protar and has researched him down, traced his family, found out a great deal about him, and she has enough to publish a book, but she has never actually done it yet. So I wish she would, because
that's a fascinating story.
A wonderful story.
Newspaper publisher and a highly educated man
who escaped from Russia, and at the time when, you know, people were, the Tsar was in danger and the revolution was going on and everything, and came over here, and how he found this particular spot in all the United States to come and settle in.
And start an entirely different reclusive
life. Right, reclusive life, and actually ministered to the people as a doctor, and they called him doctor, although he was not. He was really a pharmacist and just a very good first aid person. And that's what we're back to again now. On the island, no doctors.
You have no doctors.
No, back to this. If you're ill, they're picked up to be on the day the doctor's coming over from Charlevoix. Otherwise, you'll be flown off, and you know.
The doctor comes. Medical doctor comes over from Charlevoix on a week.
Once a week.
Once a week.
But in the winter, that may not be true, because he may not be able to get here.